part two.
Just a couple of things back to tennis itself. So there's another bit of the book where he was saying, once you develop how to swing a tennis racket, letting the natural swing of the racket determine the shot was a big thing, and not focusing on the mechanics of the shot as you're playing the shot. You learn the mechanics, and then it comes back to trust. Just as we said, self one is the pushy parent who doesn't trust their children to do anything. You've got to trust yourself to some extent. You know, because, I mean, if you're playing a tennis match or a table tennis match, it's not life or death. You know, you're not playing with someone's life. So, you know, take a risk, try things, try and have fun with it. You put in the notes here, I've got some experiences about thinking about the score while on court. So could you share that with us?
Yeah, that is the classic folly. And I think you probably resonate with this, but, you know, I am a very amateur tennis player, let me say that. But, you know, we started to kind of play with the same group of folks at the club, joined the intramural house league, so to speak. And so you just add this little bit of competition to what Sarah, my wife, and I started doing as a couple's hobby. Now we've elevated to just this little bit of stress that comes with competition and invigoration too. It's all good. But, you know, that very moment where you get up 40 love, let's say, right? Okay, I got this in the bag. You know, I'm serving 40 love. My serve is on point. Everything is good. Okay, one more. And if you miss it, like, okay, well, I had one to give, right? Or I have two more to give, no problem. They're not going to come back two more before. And as soon as you start thinking that way, it almost inevitably always happens. The mindset, I think, the flip side of it that you need to have is one more, sure, but right here, right now is the only thing that matters. Don't think that I've got three more to give. I've got to do it now, or I'm going to do it now, is what I think the desperation of I've got to do it now is even a little bit too judgmental, if you will, right? You can do it, just go and do it. And it happens a lot too when you're in a tight match, let's say, and it can happen even on the game scale where you're up 4-1, say, and I've got a break and a half under my belt. But at the very moment that you start thinking, okay, if I just, you know, hold serve now for two more cycles, I'll be okay. And all of a sudden, the fact of saying two more times, you're two ahead instead of one ahead. Honestly, as soon as I start thinking, I'm learning this the hard way in intramural tennis, but as soon as you start thinking too far ahead, it's done. It's finished. You know, like, it gets me every time.
Yeah. I've got two things to say about that. It's very interesting. Number one, I suppose if I was 40 love up or if I was ahead in a table tennis match, I think the only thing that would change was that I'd probably say, oh, on the next rally, I'm going to go for my shot, knowing that I'm still going to be 40-15. But I do totally agree with you. When you start counting, when you start going, well, if I lose this one, then I'm 40-15. If I lose the next one, I've still got another chance. I think it's a subtle difference between that and saying I can go for my next shot because I've got a cushion.
Right.
All right.
Yeah, I'm not saying don't change your behavior. Yeah, you need to take advantage of situations, right?
Yeah.
That's most certainly true. But thanks for clarifying that. Once you get ahead of yourself, or even you start thinking of the negative side of it, right? If I lose this one, I got two more. No problem. Relax. That's where your guard goes down. Your mental edge is gone. The very moment you think I got one to give, your mental edge is gone.
Yeah, let me just mention the Australian Open again, because this keeps coming into my mind. So Sinner played Medvedev in the final. Medvedev is known for being a kind of a not defensive player, but he's not really a fast starter necessarily. Medvedev, because he was absolutely knackered, and over the tournament he spent 24 hours on the court. He spent a whole day in high octane tennis, which is crazy. But he decided his only way really to win is to blast Sinner off the court, and he went two sets of love up. But what was very interesting, he was 5-1 up in the second set, and he took his foot off the gas, and he ended up winning at 6-3. But they said on commentary, and I was feeling this myself, that opened the door for Sinner, because he thought, this guy's taken his foot off the gas already. And Sinner, as people will know, came back and won 3-2. So, yeah, it's very interesting. I think, let me introduce another idea, which might seem a bit controversial. I've read lots of books on psychopathy, okay? And number one, most psychopaths do not go around killing people. That's a Hollywood thing. I'm not recommending psychopathy because it's got lots of ugly traits. However, there is a certain trait of people like Federer and Djokovic and other players. They develop psychopathic traits when they're winning or when they're in that situation. And all it is, you know, they don't go over the other side of the net and twat their opponent over the head with their racket. They're not going to be punching anyone. All they do is there's a coldness that comes over them and a kind of a cold efficiency that comes over them. And one of the things I've started implementing in table tennis, and again, I can't remember if I figured this out myself or someone told me, I can't remember, but what I do now, I don't look at the face of the person I'm playing at all. All I do is watch their bat and the ball. And obviously, there's a rhythmic, almost a meditative thing. I think they mentioned it in the book about meditating on the flight of the ball, both when you're hitting it and when your opponent's hitting it. Because when I play a match in local league, when you play a good shot, the other person will probably say, oh, good shot. And there's a kind of friendliness. And some guys kind of talk through the match, which really does my head in. I'm like, I don't want to do that at all. So what I do, I actually do go kind of a bit cold, not in an unfriendly way. I just don't address the person at all. And it really helped me. It's had such a massive help. That's not to say, you know when you get a net cord, when the ball hits the net and goes over and you kind of apologize. I'll do that. But I'm not going to start having a conversation and be Mr. Nice Guy. I do have a kind of coldness,
which really
helps me, you know?
I have a lot to learn in that respect. I am so mentally weak the other way that I care so much. Well, and I do this socially, right? So I'm playing it with friends, right? People that I do count as friends. So it's hard to want to destroy them in the way that, you know, pure competition would need to. But in the same sense, though, I'll get up. I'm a lefty, and I have a developing lefty slice serve, which for most club players is you don't see many lefties, especially with a slice, right? Mm. So then I can get up in games. It's amazing how people forget that I'm lefty too, or they just don't see it, right? So it's an advantage, and I start to feel bad about it sometimes. You know, if I get an early lead, even if they should and could have known that I'm a lefty and should be adjusting and they aren't, I just start to feel guilty in a way that it's not fair.
Yeah.
And I take my foot off the gas a lot of times, or I make conciliatory comments that, oh, it's just the lefty trying to, get them. But boy, is that self-defeating, right? Like if I could detach from wanting to be liked, I think is really what it is.
Mm.
I would have a lot more success on the tennis court. That would come at a cost, maybe, but I think there would be a deepened relationship with the people too. I'm not doing myself any favors by doing this. So I'm interesting you brought that up.
Well, I'm friendly just before the match, and I'm friendly straight after the match. It's just when I get in the match, I'm not massively invested in winning these matches. It's just nice, you know. It's a nice personal thing. To
succeed, feel better if you play better, right? Whether you win or lose, you feel better if you know you've given it your best, right? And mental focus will help you play your best.
Yeah,
right?
But if I'm being brutally honest with myself, I do want to win these matches. I do feel good when I win. But at the same time, I think there's a way of really wanting to win, but having a strange detachment from it at the same time. And that's where this thing of taking a bit more time, not being too urgent about it. But can I ask you a question while you're talking about this? Would you like to be less friendly and win more matches, or are you happy? If you don't mind a personal question, but
yeah, no problem.
Is that something you'd like to change, or are you happy with it?
Just like you say, I want to win. Winning feels better than losing. That's a fact, right? I mean, I don't want to win, at the expense of personal relationships.
Yes,
that's
of course. Yeah, yeah.
But I want to feel at the end of matches, because it feels terrible, Anthony, when you are up 4-1 and you take your foot off the gas because you feel bad. When the match is over, you know you didn't give it your best effort. And so I think there's a level of letdown on the other side of the net too, a feeling of unfulfillment that they didn't beat me at my best either, that they know something happened in between my ears and I took my foot off the gas, because they can feel it too, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so if I was to keep my foot on the gas and still lose, I would feel much better about the result than walking away knowing I could have done better.
Right. Well, my answer to that would be, I don't think you have to be friendly during the match. It doesn't mean you're run friendly. You know, if someone plays a good shot, you could say good shot. If you get a neck cord, you can put your hand up and say sorry. You don't have to be like a, you know, this cold kind of monster. But
I don't have to be their friend in the match either.
I don't think you do. If it's bothering you, like if it's not bothering you, then fine. But if you feel like you would like to change that a little bit, just kind of try it, and you'll see that, you know, the other person's, I don't know. I don't know if they'll suddenly say, oh, you know, Daryl's not as friendly as you normally is. You can be friendly right before the match and right after the match. But I kind of just become a bit of a beast just during the match. I stop looking at the person's face, as I said, which has helped me a lot. Because if you're looking at someone else's face, even if they look stressed or whatever, it's actually a distraction. The only distraction that kind of helps me is when I hear the person criticizing themselves. Because like I say, I feel like I've almost won then.
Yeah,
I'm not trying to make anyone feel bad, but I think you could, maybe as an experiment, just try that kind of ruthlessness. I think it would just be interesting, you know, I'm all for just trying things, you know, see if it works.
This is what sports is giving us, right, is an opportunity to grow. We're not going to be professional at anything sports-wise, I don't think. So, you know, use it as a life lesson, right? Use it as a way to grow.
Absolutely. Right, if you don't mind, I'm just going to skim over a few bits here that we've got here on this document. So the downside of positive thinking, I kind of talked about this in the Derren Brown episodes. If you judge something as positive, it means you're judging something else as more negative or negative, which I think you have mentioned that already. You're putting a label on it. You know, there's nothing wrong with saying to yourself, oh, that was a good shot. It's just don't obsess about that, because I think there was a thing in the book, Galway was talking about, as soon as he told this lady that her shot was going really well, she started missing, because in fact, just the judgment of it as a good shot made her nervous.
Yeah.
If you have a bad habit, don't necessarily try and correct it. Just observe it and try to feel what it should be. So there was a thing of, if you're trying to hit good shots, try and visualize where you want the ball to end up and try to feel it. It sounds a bit woo-woo to some people, but I think actually, you know, you do need to learn the mechanics of tennis or table tennis or whatever it is. There's nothing wrong with learning how to play shots. But at some point, you've got to stop analysing every second of everything you're doing. You've got to just trust. I think one of the key words of the conversation we're having is trust. Trusting yourself, trusting your child if you're a parent or whatever it is.
Well, I think that's where the practice is for, right? That you're doing the technical side of things in practice, but don't try to correct things like in a match or you know, while you're playing, right? There's a time and a place for it. In order to get self to the doer in a place where it can do, they need to learn. No one is born with these talents. Not many people anyways, right? you've got to put in some practice and do that side of it in order for self to be able to do its thing, right? And that's where professionals can help, etc. But it's very limited, I think, is what the book is talking about. That the technical learning is not where the success will come.
Mm. Let me mention Borg again. I mentioned him earlier. Do you know the story of in the old days, it was very, very difficult to win the French Open and to win Wimbledon straight after. It's still difficult now, but the French court has got faster and Wimbledon courts have got slower. So the difference between the two is not the same. And the French Open, for those who don't know, is on... it's more like dust than clay, but they call it red clay. And Wimbledon is on grass, and it comes straight after the French Open. So the transition is very difficult. Now, Borg was almost unbeatable in the French Open. He was like Nadal is now. And he never played any pre-Wimbledon tournaments because he said, or someone, maybe his coach said years later, when he started practicing on grass, it was just embarrassing. He was just terrible. It was just embarrassing. And what Borg would do was actually kind of force himself to become a grass court player over a week or so of private practice. And if you actually look at Borg's life, he paid a massive price for being the way he was, this kind of iceman with all these pent-up feelings. You know, he kind of went a bit crazy after he retired. Well, first of all, he retired when he was 25, which is a thing. Again, I can't even remember where I was going with that. You can kind of think your way. I think Borg seemed to be quite a cerebral person. So he would almost think himself into becoming a grass court player. But I think what we were coming to really was about feeling it. You've got to feel it and you've got to trust. It's like an actor, right? If I did a little bit of acting years ago. You learn the script, but when you get out on the stage, you've got to trust that you've learned the script. And if you forget one of your lines, you can either cue the other person, you can give them a signal. There's a sort of thing in acting where someone forgets their line, there's a kind of a cue they can give to the actor to say, well, can you get me out of trouble? Or you can improvise. And it's very similar, you know, you can't act in a Shakespeare play without learning the lines. But similarly, you've got to put some feeling into it. You can't just rely on learning the lines and nothing else.
I think that's right. I've never acted, but like, how do you channel, how do you be a convincing actor without actually feeling the feelings, right?
Exactly, yeah.
You don't do it with self-one. There's no self-one involved if you're portraying feelings, right? It's all feeling. It's all doing, right? It's not thinking.
I suppose the self-one thing would be you trying to remind yourself of the next line. That right. would be a kind of a self-one because you're talking to yourself. You've got but the adult telling you.
If you're an actor, a professional actor, that you would know the lines so well, you would have practiced and memorized so much beforehand that it would feel organic. In the same that the tennis stroke and, you know, feels you've done it so many times that, or that's the goal anyways, that when the pressure mounts, you're still just doing something you've done so many times it's natural.
Yeah, it's an old joke. It takes a lot of practice to be this natural. Yeah, it's a kind of joke that you... I kind of do this with my teaching. I mean, I've got a little bit blasé after 20 years, to be honest. But, I still think I do a decent job. But I found a way of where I would prepare more material than I needed. And then when I got in there, I could relax knowing that I was never going to run out of material. It's a nice little trick I had. My left brain would prepare. My adult would prepare. So then I could let my child go in the classroom, knowing that I wouldn't run out of material.
That's a good lesson, though, right? Like, it's not that there's no need for self-one or no need for preparation. That's not what it's about, right? There's a big part of it requires preparation. You can't just ad lib or flow your way through life either. It takes some preparation. I mean, even this chat that we're having that... feels like a organic chat, but we have, you know, 2 pages of notes to kind of guide, right? Like it's...
And we've got six, have we got six more that we need to get through? But.
Yeah. It would be, if you were to record and try to edit one of our sessions, I guess, or our life coaching, right? It wouldn't be this, well, we're trying to make it useful to for someone else to listen to, right? It wouldn't be. And then that requires some preparation.
Yeah, I think everything we're talking about, I feel like people can identify. I think, you know, whether you're a tennis player or another sportsman or you're just involved in life, which we all are, I think there's bits you can take. I wanted to talk about, there's a thing in the book about role-playing and channeling. Have you ever been in a situation, either in a tennis match or anywhere, where you've kind of channeled another person or you've channeled a confident person, or have you ever done that on the court? Have you ever tried that?
I haven't. You told me about this yesterday, so I'll let you explain it. But I'm going to try it, though. It sounds helpful.
No, it's good. I was saying I channel Djokovic. I kind of say, right, imagine I'm Djokovic. And I'm quite good at role-playing because I loved acting when I did it. And I think we're all playing roles in life anyway. We have to do that anyway when we go out in the world. So if I'm in a local table tennis thing, I might pretend I'm in the Wimbledon final. I don't know, whatever works for me. And I channel Djokovic and I think, what would Djokovic do? How would he stay calm? And I start to enjoy what you might call the business end of a match. You know, if you get to, we play best of 5 sets, same as the tennis, funnily enough. First to 11, best of 5 sets. If I get in a 5th set and I get to 7-all, I think, I actually enjoy it. I start to enjoy it. And I start to think, probably the other person's not enjoying it because I don't think most people like pressure. And that's not judgment, that's just... from my experience.
Yeah, you start to feel that way when you start doing something at a decent proficiency level, right? That, you know, you want to succeed, you want to win. But you know, I've started to relish, you know, the tight match a little bit better now, right? I, you know, crave the, well, at least for me, it's, you know, the 5-5. I have a group of men that we play doubles with, and it gets pretty competitive, even though it's not part of a league or anything. But this feeling of, oh, man, we can't lose. You know, it starts to feel good rather than, you know, I remember in some of my high school basketball experience, you know, not relishing those moments, kind of fleeing from them, I guess, rather than embracing. And you know, in my old age now, becoming a little bit more mature, but seeking those rather than dreading them, I guess.
Yeah.
But I'm gonna try it. Next time I'm up 4-1 and feeling bad about my lefty slice serve or something like that, I'm gonna channel, what would Djokovic do?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Did I tell you that I was left-handed as well?
I think you did a while
ago. Yeah, that's another. I didn't realize you were left-handed. There you go. Found another common thing. That's great. I want to talk also about serving, because tennis is a unique sport. If you imagine with boxing, imagine if someone just gets a free hit. Other guy's just got to stand there and you get a free hit.
No.
Tennis, you have this amazing thing which works as such a perfect metaphor. In theory, okay, if I was, let's say I'm playing Djokovic, all right? Fairly confident I'm not going to win, but in theory, I could hit a serve. If I placed it perfectly, I could possibly win all, I'm talking hypothetically, I could win all my service games. Because tennis is this unique thing where if you have a pretty decent serve, you can hit a fairly unreturnable serve. Djokovic is a bad example because he's probably the best returner in the history of the game. But let's take whoever, Medvedev or whoever. Don't you think it's an interesting thing that tennis has where you get this kind of, you've got this free hit that you've got complete control over? It's interesting, isn't it? And I put in my notes here, the serve is a great metaphor for life. You have control of it. Just as you have control over your reactions. Now, okay, it's not always easy not to be triggered, okay? We all have trigger points. And during our life coaching sessions, we talked about family, and family is usually the biggest trigger point of all. Members of your family can hit your buttons like nobody else you ever meet. But you do have control over it. And I don't know, how do you feel when you serve? Does it feel like an opportunity or does it feel like pressure?
Yeah, and someone else explained to me too that I think this is true, but this tennis serve is the only thing in any sport that you get two chances to do one thing.
Ah, yes, you're right. Yeah,
which I find that really profound if you just have to think about it too. But yeah, I don't feel, well, I guess it ebbs and it flows. Sometimes it's a big advantage, but you know, because I'm such a amateur player that my serve isn't reliable. And you know, my best serve has a lot of luck involved with it. And so, yes, while I'm standing there with the ball and I have maybe a bit of an advantage in that I'm controlling it, you know, which serve is going to show up today or this time is more the factor. And that's because I'm an amateur, right? I'm also going to go on the record and say, I don't think you could ace Medvedev.
Yeah, maybe, I don't know. In theory,
down on earth with me. But yeah, no, it's a good because you bring this up, and I if I had to say, I would honestly feel probably more pressure than opportunity in that moment.
Right.
I think it's a good identification of a negative feeling, an opportunity to make better, right?
Well, let me share another thing I've kind of developed in my table tennis. Table tennis is a little bit different. Because it's smaller, I think you have a bigger range of services. And table tennis bats are quite different from tennis rackets in that you actually buy the rubbers and the blade. Yeah, the blade is the wooden thing that you hold, and then you've got rubbers on either side.
Yeah.
Players who play fairly seriously, you buy the rubbers and the blade independently and you tailor them to your game. So you've actually got access to a lot more spin. And you can also place the ball because it's traveling such a shorter distance. So what I do when I'm losing, in table tennis you get two serves each, and it's best to 11 in a set. You get, used to be 21, but now it's 11. You get two serves each. If I'm losing, if I've got the ball in my hand, I will take a bit longer. I'll take an extra few seconds. Just take a bit more time to think about where I'm going to place it. And I will try and play a different serve than I've been playing earlier. And in a way, I'm almost trying to literally and metaphorically or psychologically use that advantage by keeping that ball in my hand a bit longer. And I've just found something that works, and it's hard to know how it affects the other person or whether it affects the other person, but it almost doesn't matter. If it makes you feel better, you can't control what the other person's going to do anyway. You know, okay, you can by the quality of your shots, but yeah, I didn't even think of that you get two chances as well, because there are people lobbying to have one serve, and I'm like, absolutely not, because it's so brilliantly tense when someone's on their second serve, you know, in a big match.
Yeah, And well, to that you like that there are two serves, right? You give it your all on your first. You try your hardest to give it your best. Now it's becomes the chess match, right? Mm. You go for it on the second as well. Do you play it safe, opening the door for the other player? It's, I think it's brilliant, actually.
Oh, I love it. And the idea as well, I think it was sort of pioneered by Ivan Isovic, you know, now coaches Djokovic. If you watch Ivan Isovic's matches, he was amazing. He was such a character. I think he, I don't know if he pioneered it, but he was one of the first people to ever hit second serve aces. And again, it's kind of a metaphor for life. If you mess up the first time, do you have to play safe the second time? Or can you just go for it the second time as well? So it's
and,
good...
and in tennis, you get so many chances of this that you don't, like, it changes, right? The reason to do one or the other on your second serve changes, and thus the tennis or the chess match begins, right? The,
absolutely.
The mental game, right? There's so much that can happen because of that ability to have a second serve.
Yeah, and it's so unique to tennis, isn't it? Because I can't think of any other, I think you're right, yeah, I can't think of any other sport where you get that. You've got that free hit, as we said, and you get two chances at it. I think it's brilliant.
Yeah.
Okay, let's move on to, I feel like we've already been talking about this anyway, concentration, which is defined as the act of focusing your attention. When the mind is focused on one thing only, it stills. So this is kind of a provable fact. Meditate on the ball. Don't look at the other. This is something I wrote, I told you earlier. Don't look at the other person's face. Try to completely ignore who your opponent is, except to know their strengths and weaknesses. Now, let's talk about this. So one of the things that they often say on this podcast is that Djokovic, go back to Djokovic again, because he's kind of my favorite player, he has an aura, and they feel like a lot of the other players will fold purely on the strength of playing him. Now, do you remember, I don't know if you're a boxing fan, but do you remember Mike Tyson in the 80s when he emerged? I mean, again, it's different because Mike Tyson could kill you. I mean, literally, you know, these boxers could kill the man on the street with one punch, probably. It's a little bit different, but Tyson had an aura where the other guy just looked scared to death. And in tennis, again, you're not being hit directly, but I think when he plays, for example, Taylor Fritz just doesn't believe he's going to win. I can just feel it even watching it on the TV. So let me ask you a question. If you were playing the best player in the town, and the probability is that you're not going to win. Let's say you got to the final of a tournament and you really wanted to win. Would you be able to play this guy and completely ignore who he was? Would you be able to do that if you kind of concentrated?
I mean, I think it would take some practice, but if this happened today, say, it would not. I mean, even just talking this through, I'm identifying lots of opportunities for me to strengthen my mental focus, which I've known when my family tells me all the time that I have ADHD in a joking kind of way, I think. I lack the ability to concentrate and focus. And it plays into a lot of parts of my life, but it's the world that we live in too, right? Mm. Made for instant gratification. It's, you know, I don't feel too bad about it, although I do know it's a habit, I suppose, that's affecting my life, right? So no, I mean, if I was to play the best player in the club today, I would be in awe, right, of his tennis game. I would be in awe of the practice he puts in, right? I'd be in awe of his fitness is probably a lot better than mine, too. You know, I would not be thinking about that I could win. But if I could think that, I would probably put up a better fight.
Yes, but maybe if we just tweak that a little bit, maybe not even think about whether you're going to win or not. But just, I'm thinking through this.
I got to park the awe. I can't be in awe of the person and their game, right? I have to think I belong.
Yeah, but maybe it's not even that. It's almost like, okay. let me, I've just come up with this analogy in the moment. Okay, imagine you're playing a computer, all right? Okay, let's say you're playing chess. Okay, I play chess a little bit. I used to be all right. So rusty, it's crazy. But on this website, you can play the computer and you can set the computer from level 1 to level 10.
Yeah.
If you were playing chess against a computer on level 10, if I was playing chess, the likelihood is I'm not going to win, all right? I'm fairly okay with that. But because it's a computer, it's not emoting any kind of aura to you. You've just set it to go at number 10. So if you think about it, you can't really affect that computer's performance. And if you're playing the best guy in the town, you could try a load of gamesmanship and say, I was with your wife last night or whatever, yeah, you could try all that. But let's say for argument's sake, you're not going to do that. So you're playing someone who it has some similarity to playing a computer in the sense that you're not necessarily going to affect their performance. But if you think about it, if you're playing a computer, you would give yourself the best chance by just completely forgetting the fact that you've set that computer to level 10. And I've just come up with that in the moment, so I don't know if that makes sense. But I know it's not easy to do. Saying something intellectually and doing it is two different things. I totally get that. But
isn't it just self too, though? Like, that's what you're getting at, right? What the level you've set the computer to is an external measure, an external judgment, realistically, of your opponent, right? Mm-hmm. You trust yourself too enough and are focused enough on the game itself. It doesn't matter that it's a computer, first off. It doesn't matter what level it's set to either. You're going to be in the state that yourself too is putting its best foot forward, right?
Yes. And if I don't look at the opponent, let's play, I'm playing the best guy in the town, which I am, I said, going to be next week. It's already happened by the time people are hearing this. But if I don't look him in the face, then there's not that much difference between playing him and playing a computer, is there, really? I'm not comparing people to computers, but unless, he's a guy who talks a lot or shouts out, if you don't pay any attention, then that person can't really affect you. Their tennis or their table tennis can affect you. And I know it's not easy. I'm saying it's not easy to do. And I'm not saying you should do this. I'm talking for the audience. I'm talking for myself. I haven't got this nailed by any stretch. But it's an interesting thing where if you let self two go, and if you think of the other person's aura, as you said, as a self one thing, as an external that's affecting you, you have control over whether that affects you or not.
Yeah.
Not easy, but you've got control over it. I think it's interesting, yeah.
You just jogged my memory, though, or not my memory, but I just thought of this, too. How does self two relate to chess? Because chess takes a lot of thinking, right?
Yeah, I don't think that probably works. I guess I came up with it just because I was thinking that people play chess against a computer, don't they?
Yeah.
Well, actually, funny enough, my dad's a table tennis player. He has a robot. And you don't play games against it, but it's brilliant, actually. He sets it at the other end of the table, but you can program this robot to give you fast, slow, backspin, topspin. So I suppose maybe the table tennis robot might be a slightly better metaphor than chess, because you're absolutely right. You don't really have a self too in chess.
It's like a ball machine, though, in tennis. Your dad's
Yeah,
robot.
A ball machine, exactly, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, but you could actually program the ball machine to give you really fast. And then the competition aspect might be, can I return this shot?
Right.
Yeah, probably the chess on one level wasn't the best metaphor. But
I find the book interesting. He's got the 2/3 of the book is all about the self one, self two dynamic,
mm-hmm.
And kind of convincing you, if you will, or laying the thesis that self two is better. If you live in self two, you're going to be better. And it sort of lays that out in the first 2/3. And the last third is all about concentration and focus.
Mm.
And so it's like, well, to me, like there is some tennis tips in this book, but they mostly are in the concentration focus side, where they're giving you tips of how to focus on the tennis court. And that's really the first time that he really talks about actually playing tennis or anything tactical about tennis, right? But there's only two things that he really talks about when you boil it down, I think, is one, knowing where your racket head is, and number two, watching the ball. And when you think about, it's back to the meditation thing a little bit, but if you can get to that state on the court or in life, it's actually very simple to, well, once you stop your judgment and you are starting to ignore your self one and live within self two, then these concentration tricks will help you prolong that feeling.
Yeah, no, absolutely. All these things they're just a mixture of practice and then letting self two do the business. Something you said earlier was about if people just lived in self two the whole time. I've met people like that. You find this a lot with musicians. I knew musicians in Madrid. I won't mention any names because I wasn't much better than them, I'll be honest. who just seemed to live completely in the moment. And so they were just totally chaotic. Like they would just be 2 hours late for rehearsals and things because they're, quote, living in the moment, you know. But yeah. you need an adult. You can't just be a child. You need an adult, but you've got to let the child go at the same time. And I think that's, you know, that's one of the metaphors we can come up with.
It's funny, though, right? Because that type of personality that you're describing is a lot of very successful, you bring up music, I guess, right? But the true artists seem to live that way. And it's a pain for their manager or a boon to their team, right? Who's trying to book studio time from X time to Y time. But they show up and then they make music happen and it's magical, right? There's many stories of that. You're closer, that's more your world than mine, but not everybody who's like that is successful, right? And not everyone who's successful is like that either.
Yeah, but these people often, again, I'm only generalizing because there's millions of rock stars out there, but they often have very difficult lives though as well, because they can't manage their lives and they often find they don't have the ability to do anything. They need someone to, you know, when you become, I'm not a rock star obviously, but I've read enough about it. Those people that just live in the moment, they really need people. They need an adult almost to organize their lives because they can't plan ahead. So maybe they're successful in the sense of they make great music or they write great songs, but how successful are their personal lives? I don't know. You know, it depends on the person, but
it probably helps
the art. Yeah. Would you agree that in your life you need an adult and a child within you? You need a child to enjoy your life almost, and an adult to almost temper it.
I think that's a lesson I need to learn a bit. I live in a pretty strict self-one mindset a lot of the time. You know, and it has to do with getting married young. It has to do with having kids young. It has to do with, you know, a bit of the way I was raised too, right? So I feel like in my later years, you know, the pandemic, for all of its faults, it jogged me to start rethinking a number of different things. And maybe it's getting mature, getting older, my kids getting older and, you know, entering a new phase of my life and their lives, etc. All of that kind of happened at the same time as the pandemic, right? And, so maybe it would have happened without the pandemic too, who knows? But all of this has kind of rethought the way that I think of life. And one of the big takeaways, well, to help me articulate it in this book's terms, you know, I need to live more in the self too, in everything I do. I need to have more of a childlike state. I think I've been trying to grow up too fast. Right. And, you know, having kids young and getting married young, and I've always known this, you know, there's a trade-off to doing so. There are certain experiences that my friends or my peers have had in their early 20s that, you know, where I was changing diapers and raising babies. And now some of those folks are, you know, living that life now, and I'm living a different life, right? They're not playing tennis three times a week like I am, right? Or so whatever it is. But yeah, I need to not regress, but I need to live self too more in my day-to-day life. That's really what it is. I need to do, not think.
Yeah, well, I you probably know from Life and Life Only that I love cats.
Yeah.
And I also love kids as well. I don't have kids of my own, but I've got four nephews and a niece, and I saw them growing up, and I know it's not the same, but if you watch children and also cats and dogs, you can learn so much from them, okay? This is what I'm saying almost. You couldn't be a five-year-old child all your life because you have to mature and you have to have some skills in organizing your life. If you think of this rock star idea that we're talking about, someone like John Lennon almost admitted he couldn't do anything for himself after a while because you've had people doing it for you the whole time. But if you watch, I always just say, watch animals. Yeah, you know, a cat couldn't get a job and couldn't support a family and earn money, but you can still learn from watching them. They have this sort of instinct. And there's a book called... it's why zebras don't get ulcers. And it's talking about how animals do feel stress, but they don't dwell on it. They move on very quickly. And all I'm saying is, I know my mind's going a bit mad at the moment, but if you take children or you take animals because they're very instinctive, what I'm saying is you can learn from them.
Yeah.
So what you're saying is that you became very proficient at one aspect of life, which was getting married and raising a family. You've done that. Whereas another, say you had a friend or other people didn't get married, and maybe they seem like they're having more fun, but you had a different kind of fulfillment. So having established that, what you're saying, right, is you need to, as you said, regress. You need to go back to that childlike state to kind of complement what you've already built in your life. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. Getting married and having kids young has put me into a self-one kind of mindset, right? I've needed to plan. Getting married young means money's tight.
Hmm.
It required different things, I guess, than what a normal 23 or 25 year old would be considering, right? So, and I'm certainly not expressing any regrets with that. It just is. And now when my kids are getting older, I know exactly what you're talking about. You know, kids and dogs and cats, animals live in self too all the time. They're just doing, they're not thinking, right? They're instinctual.
Yes.
And now that my kids are older and they're getting, you know, into some self-one on their own.
Yeah.
And boy, this is the hard part to swallow, because I can see my fingerprints on their self-one. You know what I mean? No doubt we're all influenced by our parents, and there's some responsibility that comes with when I see it. You know, that my bad habits perpetrating in my children. It's not a good feeling, but this is the balance. They're great kids. They're going to be successful. They're, you know, happy kids. They've done a lot of growing over the last couple of years, as I have too. And there's no, at least for me personally, and, you know, based on the life choices I've made, that it's very fulfilling to see them come into their own. But it is also kind of heartbreaking to see my fingerprints on their challenges. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, but you shouldn't think of it as heartbreaking. I think you should think of it as a wonderful thing. You brought a life into the world and you're seeing them flourish. Is it to do with the fact that they get to a certain age and they lose a certain spontaneity, which we all do? Is that part of it?
Yeah, they're growing up, right? They're moving into challenges of their own with procrastination, etc. Things that, you know, they've got grown-up problems, or they're heading into grown-up problems, right? Which is all part of the journey, right? They're going to learn it the way that I'm learning it eventually, which is there's no right and wrong way to do it. It's just the way that it's done, that it happened, right? There's no good shots. There's no bad shots.
Absolutely. I'm just thinking, actually, with the self one, self two, for those who are of a psychology bent, you might be listening. We can equate it to left brain and right brain as well, can't we? Because the left hemisphere of the brain is to do with logic and making decisions, and the right brain is to do with creativity and being more in the moment. So what you're really saying is that your left brain has been well exercised by what you've had to do, having kids, and you've obviously learned some very useful and admirable skills of organizing and having to be responsible and things like that, that someone who hasn't got married and had kids maybe is lacking. So I wouldn't, you know, I think you should feel good about that. But you're just looking for maybe spending more time in the right brain, perhaps what it comes down to.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. I'm looking to exercise my creative muscles more so than my practical muscles.
Yeah, your organizational muscles. Yeah.
Yeah,
very good. Have you got anything else you'd like to say about the book? Because I was just going to read a couple of my diary notes. I won't read all of it.
Yeah, go ahead.
I think we'll bring an end to the inner game of tennis side. We will be talking about tennis later, though. But when I read this book last year, I'm a sort of quite prolific diary person. I've had a journal or a diary since I was about 16, and I've recommended it many times. Not for everyone, of course, but journaling is such a fantastically therapeutic thing to do. Anyway, I'm just going to read just a few quick paragraphs of stuff I wrote about the book. So true winning is about taking on challenges with a spirit of adventure and fun and overcoming obstacles to achieve a goal. The supreme effort and the process can often be more rewarding than an external victory, in quote marks. This is interesting. The person competing against you is helping you discover what heights you can achieve, and vice versa. Competition is therefore cooperation. And I've got here, which explains why McEnroe genuinely didn't want Borg to quit in 1982. So Bjorn Borg quit in 1981, 82, and McEnroe would actually ring him up and say, hey man, you know, when are you coming back? I'm genuinely missing you, because Borg made McEnroe better. And yes, you know, McEnroe's going to win more titles without Borg there, but I genuinely think a part of him wanted him there. So that's an interesting thing. Unless you know the game is a real high level, it's not life or death. If we're playing a local match, think of the other person as your opponent as actually helping you to get better, and you're helping him or her to get better. So I love that.
You think about the Federer-Nadal rivalry over the years, right? And would Federer have been what he was without Nadal pushing him and on his coattails, right? Just by sheer age, Federer had a time advantage, but then Nadal caught up very quickly and the race was on for the titles. And then, you know, Djokovic starts climbing and, you know, with the express goal of breaking into this two-man party that was there, right? And then Andy Murray comes along for a while, the big four. And now Djokovic is on the way out now, eventually, soon, someday, maybe, he'll be finished. And who will take over, right? It's been a golden age of tennis, but I don't believe that without those high, like three once-in-a-generation players, and, you know, I guess put Andy Murray in there for a little while, but four one-in-a-generation players in a single generation, it'll be hard to match.
I mean, the idea that three players could beat Sampras's record within 20 years is just insane. I mean, no one could have predicted that. Nobody. It's absolutely crazy.
It wouldn't have happened. That's the point you're making, right? It wouldn't have happened with each other. The three of them, four of them egged each other on, right? Made them all better.
This is the thing. The ego side of you, the success-driven part of you would say, if you're Federer, would say, well, if Nadal didn't exist, I probably would have won 10 more Grand Slams. Okay, Djokovic came along, Murray came along. But I honestly think genuinely he probably thanks him as well. Because the heights they reach are just crazy, you know.
There's a flip side to that, right? Like Nadal stood in his way on 10 direct. I'm just using that number, making it up, for taking it further. But without him standing in the way, Federer may not have had the motivation to work as hard. You know, wouldn't have won another five that he did win because he was that much more prepared, right? It's a rising tide that's raised the four ships, right?
There you go, yeah. I don't know if I've already read this. A match is only a zero-sum game in terms of the result. In fact, both players can be winners in terms of what they get out of it. Playing to someone's weaknesses may seem cruel, but you're actually helping them. Now, this is the bit that's a bit tricky. As you said, if you're in a match and you're 4-1 up and you target the other guy's backhand because you know it's not very good, I see where you're coming from. That would feel a bit uncomfortable. And it would be difficult.
It doesn't need to be, right? It's not life. It's just sports, right?
Yeah, but it would be difficult to say to him at the end, well, you know, the reason I was playing your backhand was actually to help you. You wouldn't be able to say that, but he's saying inadvertently that's what you're doing, you know?
That's a lesson they would need to learn, right? If they want to learn it, I'd be helping them learn it. But that mindset is, I don't have that mindset. I need to learn that mindset.
Yeah. I've written here, is it possible, I wonder, to attach no importance at all to winning my table tennis matches? The irony is that I'm more likely to win by doing this. This is the detachment. This is the relaxation you get from detachment. Think of yourself as a seed of a tree with all the potential already within it and just needing time for inevitable development using all the rain and sunshine that comes its way, rather than a building which needs to have stories added to it to reach greater height. So that's the difference. There's a philosopher called Alan Watts, who I absolutely loved. He was a guy from England and he moved to California and he was a big part of introducing Eastern ideas, you know, along with the Beatles going to India. He introduced the Eastern ideas, if that's not too general, to Western society. And he said, yeah, I like being in nature because everything wiggles, leaves wiggle in the wind, you know, that kind of thing. As you said, when you plant a seed, everything that you need is within that seed already. All you got to do is just let nature take its course. And I love that. But rather than a building is something where you decide 28 stories isn't enough. I'm going to build the 29th story on top of it.
The mindset I find fascinating, right? If you care less about the results, then you'll get more results. There's a bit in the book, actually, I wouldn't mind reading. If you don't
mind. Sure, yeah, of course.
chapter 9, and it's talking about exactly this, winning or losing, or caring about winning. But this is what it says. The difference between being concerned about winning and being concerned about making the effort to win may seem subtle, but in the effect, there is a great difference. When I'm concerned only about winning, I'm caring about something that I can't wholly control. Whether I win or lose, the external game is a result of my opponent's skill, my effort, their effort, as well as my own. When one is emotionally attached to the results that he can't control, he tends to become anxious and try too hard. But one can control the effort he puts into winning. One can also do the best he can at any given moment. Since it is impossible to feel anxiety about an event that one can control, the more mere awareness that you are using maximum effort to win each point will carry you past the problem of anxiety. So when you wrote that, I thought of this section, but it's exactly right. And I think it's what you're trying to say. The more importance you attach to the result of winning, the more stress that it creates because it's not completely within your control. The mindset flip that Timothy Galloway is talking about is caring about the result or the effort that it takes to win or the effort you put into winning. Whether or not you win or not is not fully within your control.
Yeah, that makes sense. One thing you said there about anxiety, another thing is that if you're in the moment, I wouldn't say it's impossible to feel anxiety, but anxiety is generally related, and this is in life as well, to the future or the past. So anxiety, was it in this book he called anxiety fear of the future? I'm sure I was reading that yesterday. I can't remember. But kind of essentially what you said, isn't it? Because if you think about the shot you've just missed, then you're in the past. If you think about, as you said earlier, if you're 40 love up, if you're thinking about if I lose this, then I can still win the next 2 points. That will produce anxiety because you're projecting into the future.
Yeah.
Absolutely, yeah. Couldn't agree more. Right, I've just got one more bit to read. Then I'm going to ask you for kind of a, if you've got one final thing about the book. I've got in my, these are my diary notes. Yet another self-development book ends with an anecdote about the acceptance of death. And I say this because so many good self-development books will have a final chapter that's all about death and its acceptance and how it's not morbid. Might be morbid to think about it all the time, but to accept your own demise is not morbid. In this case, the author was in a situation where death was a possibility, and he suddenly found that running in icy cold conditions was natural and easy when he accepted that possibility. Quote, letting go of my grip on life released an energy that paradoxically makes it possible for me to run with utter abandon towards life. So again, detachment from it actually makes you have a more intimate relationship with it in a strange way. So I don't remember the exact anecdote, but it was something like he had to, did his car break down or something and he had to get somewhere.
Right.
And of course, the natural thing is you're thinking, will I get there before I freeze to death? Once you've accepted, once you've just made a decision, fuck it, I'm going to run as fast as I can, then there's no real anxiety. You might still die, you know, I'm not saying you wouldn't, but there's no anxiety in that moment because you've made a decision. And this is another thing I would want to tell to you and the listeners. With procrastination, just try and remember that feeling when you finally make a decision, how liberating that is. That moment where you finally put your chips, you know, you not, what's the metaphor?
Put your chips on the table.
You put your chips on the table. There's that lovely moment, even if you're not sure if you're making the right decision. Try and remember that liberating feeling when that happened. So I was so inspired just reading this guy. And you could probably also run much faster than you think, you know.
Yeah.
So I love that. Just to finish this section, have you got a final?
So for me, love the book. Great book. Highly recommend. I found the concept of thinking and doing self one, self two to be very eye opening. And profound and deep. And I spend a lot of time thinking about it. Another kind of mantra that I have is for my grown up life here now is to do what gives you energy. And to me that, you know, like I've mentioned a couple of times, you know, I want to try to live more in the now. I want to try to be a bit more childlike. I want to be more creative. I want to be more self too. So this book is a good, as it relates to a hobby that I really enjoy and have been working hard to develop over the last couple of years, to the game of tennis. It speaks my language, obviously, on a number of levels. And anyway, I really enjoyed the book. So I appreciate you bringing it to me. I don't know if we said this, but I only got introduced to this book via Anthony and our life coaching sessions. So I always equate my knowledge of this to you. So appreciate it, Anthony. Thank you.
Well, let's thank my dad as well, because my dad got me onto it. So it's all a chain, isn't it? You know, I'm sure you'll recommend it to someone who will be very happy that you've introduced it to their life. It's also a very short book as well, isn't it? I mean, what is it? 100-odd pages? 130 pages? Very easy read. It's not. It's deep, but it's very accessible, I think.
Yeah.
And there's probably an audio book. I imagine there's an audio book version out there somewhere. But
Not sure.
I think it's not a difficult read. And for the tennis players, I mean, there is some stuff. There is some technical stuff in there, isn't there, for the tennis players? But if you're not particularly interested in tennis, you could skip those bits and maybe get to the bits which are more metaphorical, perhaps. But
or pick up his other versions that might have something to do with your hobbies. But The Inner Game of Stress is his final book, or at least listed here. That seems interesting, right? We all deal with stress.
Yeah, The Inner Game of Work as well. I mean, I think I said earlier, you know, obviously that depends what work you do, but I think there's something common to all work. I mean, there's a few people who might tell you that they do their job for nothing, but I'm not sure if I believe that. Yeah. People have different levels of enjoyment, but I imagine, I haven't read the book, but I imagine he finds ways where you could try to make something either fun or more stimulating. Maybe a repetitive task like filing, or I don't know, whatever it could be.
End of part two.
I had the opportunity, fortunately, to play a lot of great players, won and lost, did my share of losing against a lot of them, hopefully winning some. Bjorn Borg, obviously, was my greatest rival.
He had this thing about him that was inexplicable. I don't know what it is, why it is, but it is. It's certain people have this incredible aura that I can't explain without having to do anything. It's like he got into his Superman outfit, and all of a sudden he's a different person. But he's Clark Kent. You know, would I like to be that all the time? No. But I did try and practice just for the hell of it to try to be like that. I couldn't even do that in practice. So I wasn't even going to waste my time even in attempting it in a match to be just like he was. And I felt like letting things out was actually healthier than keeping them in.